We've got something special. Stanley Jordan, the great guitar player, is here. And normally, we talk to musicians before they come into town to do a show. But Stanley Jordan is here the morning of the show. So thank you very much for being here. I know it's early. You got a long day, but thanks very much.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Let me just jump right into your music, because everybody knows your guitar playing, but you actually started out on piano, right?
Piano was my first instrument, and I credit my mother for starting me with piano lessons, and I just loved it. I used to practice for hours and hours, and sometimes my parents would come up to me and say, "You've been playing that song for a long time. Don't you want to play anything else?" Because they would get tired of hearing the same song, but that's what you have to do sometimes. Sometimes you have to just stay on one thing until you master it. I heard a story from someone who worked at a hotel. They said that there had been a guitarist playing all night one night, and somebody complained the next morning. They said, you know, somebody was playing guitar and playing the same lick all night. And they said, oh, yeah, that was Stevie Ray Vaughan. But, you know, that's what you have to do.
Let's go then from piano to guitar. How about you switch instruments?
There was a brief time we went through some difficulties with the family. They had to sell the piano. And I asked my parents then if I could get a guitar because I was starting to get interested in different music. As a pianist, and I also composed at the piano, I had been mostly inspired by the classical greats, Mozart and Bach. And I loved a lot of orchestral music, a lot of romantic music. And I started to listen to music like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and getting into a lot of blues. And I started to get excited about guitar because it seemed to me that guitar was an instrument that would be more suitable for the new music I was getting interested in. So as luck would have it, they were able to get a guitar for me. And so I played mostly rock and blues for a couple of years. And then I started to branch into jazz because what I found was that jazz pulled it all together for me because it had the sophistication and the rich structure like the classical music I had been brought up on. And it also had that raw power, that fundamental, basic, visceral thing that you get from the blues. And it kind of pulled it all together.
Let's go forward to the way that you play guitar now. I'm not asking how you do it because I think that's magic, the way that you play guitar, but what was it that, I guess, was missing from normal guitar playing that you discovered and found and put into music with the tapping technique that you have now?
Well, normally, just to play one note on guitar, you need to use both hands because you use one hand to select the note and then the other hand to pick the string to energize that sound. So what I started doing is just hitting the string with my one finger. So when the string hits the fret on the neck, that impact creates the sound. So what I'm doing is I'm playing with just one hand instead of having to use both hands. So once I'm able to play with a single hand, then I can use both hands to play two different parts. Or there's ways you can play even more than two parts at the same time. So basically, when you look at it, you see both hands on the neck instead of one down by the sound hole. And it kind of looks like playing the guitar like a piano. In fact, I got the idea from piano. So even though I wanted to move into guitar, I still had a lot of the sort of piano way of thinking. And that's what led me to experiment with the guitar.
And that's worked out so well. And watching you, I mean, sometimes I've seen videos of you and you've got the guitar on like its own separate stand. You're not even holding it like most people do. Is that kind of limiting to what you can do?
Well, when I put the guitar up on a stand, it has the advantage that the instrument's more stable. So for some things, it is easier. But as a performer, I like to move around, and that's part of the expression of the music, too. So sometimes I'd rather take my chances and maybe miss a note here and there, but still be able to express using my whole body, using the whole stage. Probably what you saw is when I usually use the stand, it's when I want to play two guitars at the same time. And the way I do that is I have one guitar on the stand and then the other guitar I'm holding. And that way I have the two separated. But either way, it's the same technique, just either on one guitar or two.
Now, the music that you play over the years, recordings and shows, is that you do a lot of covers. You mentioned that you used to compose at the piano. Do you still compose that way?
Yeah, I still compose, and my latest album, Friends, has a good mix, I think, of originals and songs that we covered. The opening track is Capital J. We had Kenny Garrett and Nicholas Payton and Christian McBride and Kenwood Dinard on that track, and that was one that I wrote. I also like to do my own arrangements of songs that were there already. Like, for example, on Friends, we also did Reverie by Claude Debussy. And that piece was something that I've loved for so long. I've just been such a big fan of Debussy. He's one of my favorite composers. And I think that he had a big, well, clearly he had a big influence on jazz, but I think that the influence went both ways as well. And so this piece, Reverie, was really ripe for a kind of a jazzy interpretation. We did a sort of a bossa nova flavor on that as well. And that was with my core trio, with Kenwood Dinard on drums and Charnette Moffett on bass. So even though that was a piece by someone else, I did it differently from the usual interpretation. Mm-hmm.
Your covers over the years, just curious, how do you pick these out? I mean, are you looking for songs that perhaps your audience will know very, very well, and then you don't have to worry about selling something brand new to the ears and instead putting more of your own playing ability into it?
Well, every song is different, and there's a different reason to play it. Well, let's take the Katy Perry song that I did, for example. On the Friends album, we did I Kissed a Girl. And the original motivation for that was when I saw the video of the song, I thought that it was kind of interesting that a song based on this sort of bi-curious fantasy would become the most popular song in the world for like 2 years or something. And I thought maybe that says something about humanity today. Maybe people are becoming more accepting or something. So I kind of thought that was interesting, and then I forgot about it. And then one day I saw Miss Perry herself did an MTV Unplugged version where she had jazz musicians playing the song with her, and she created a kind of like a jazz club kind of an atmosphere. So I saw the concept of what she was going for that, and I thought, well, wouldn't that be interesting to take that idea right there to its full conclusion and really do like an all-out jazz blues version of that song? So I decided, based on the theme of the song and based on the suggestion she made with it, I decided to put that on the album.
Well, I think of all the songs you've done, I mean, you've done so many at such a wide range, and that's what I wanted to ask, is how do you go about picking out things? You've done, like you said, the pop tunes of the day. You've done Stairway to Heaven, okay, classic Led Zeppelin song, jazz classics, and straightforward classical music, Ravel, Bartok over the years. You obviously enjoy a lot of different kinds of music.
A lot of times I'll listen to something, and it's true, I love many kinds of music. And a lot of times I'll listen to something, and in my mind, my head starts playing with it, and I start to hear other possibilities of where it could go. And if it gets interesting enough to me, then I start to think, I'd like to really do this, do these variations that I'm imagining. And also sometimes there is a thought that I know that people know certain songs, you know, so there may be a point I can make with that. Like, for example, my Standards Volume 1 album, which I did back in the 80s, there was a point where I was noticing that I was getting criticized for some of the music that I was playing because some of the jazz critics were saying, oh, you're playing all this pop music. How can you call yourself a jazz musician? And one day I woke up thinking, you know what? These are not pop songs. These are standards. These are my generation's standards, and I'm going to stand up for this music. So I decided to do the album Standards Volume 1, and a lot of that music was things that had been more recent popular songs. And I never really thought anything of that before because I knew Art Tatum did songs like I Can't Get Started and all. Everyone plays songs that were popular, and they make them into their own jazz version. So I was just doing the same thing that all the greats before me had done. And so I realized there's a point that needs to be made here. And that's where the concept came from for that album.
Well, it's one way of looking at it is you did, for instance, Paul Simon's Sound of Silence, definite standard. So who can say that Katy Perry's music won't be a standard thought of that way 20 years from now?
Right. And I think part of that is the way that you make a song a standard is by showing that there is another take on it. There are different ways of doing it. That core music can hold up in these different interpretations.
Well, let's talk about what you've been up to lately, and you've been doing a lot. I mean, the Friends album is a couple of years old, but in the meantime, recently I found out that you are into music software development. That's got to be interesting.
Oh, yeah, that's actually something that I've been involved in for quite a while, and it's not something I've really talked about so much publicly because I've just made tools for my own use and I don't have a product I'm trying to sell or anything. You know, it's just that there's always been something that I wanted that wasn't available on the market. So I figured, well, I'll just build it myself. I come from the old days of computer music. I studied serious computer music back in the 70s at Princeton with Paul Lansky. And anyone who knows those names will realize that I really do go back to the original time when the state-of-the-art systems of the day had no keyboards. The only way you could make sound was actually by programming the computer. And so I already kind of had that mentality. Now, here's the reason that this is important, because when I first found out about computer music, I was really thrilled because I realized for the first time in human history, we had an instrument that could make any possible sound. I mean, before you were limited by the physics and so forth of the instruments of your day, but now you're only limited by the loudspeaker, what can come out of a speaker. And so from a composer's point of view, this new instrument was amazing. And the catch was, though, that you had to describe the sound in a mathematical way. And I've always been fascinated by that connection between music and mathematics. While I was at Princeton, I also studied with Milton Babbitt, who, in fact, on Friends, we did a tribute song to him, one for Milton, because he had just passed away right before we recorded the album. And he was one of our great composers. I mean, what an American treasure, not only as a composer, but also as a theorist. And he was a pioneer in this mathematical musical relationship. And so it was a real thrill to study with him as well. And so a lot of these different threads kind of came together for me. And the computer, not just as an instrument, but also as a tool of thought for thinking about musical structure, became very useful.
And something else, too, you're talking about using computers to make music. You've also been using music to help people. I understand there's a music therapy side to your life.
Right, that's true. Now, I haven't so far incorporated any advanced technology into that, but that is something else that's been very interesting for me. I want everyone to know about music therapy because I predict that people are going to be using music not just for entertainment, not just for aesthetics. Not long from now, everyone will understand the healing power of music. I had an experience as a teenager in which I had a rapid healing from the flu after jamming with a friend of mine for a whole day. And I didn't know anything about music therapy at the time, but it was pretty clear to me that the music really helped to accelerate my healing process. Then later as an adult, I found out about music therapy, and I started going to some of the national conferences. And then when I went to the international conference and I saw what people were doing all around the world, I was amazed, and that's when I decided I needed to get involved on a deeper level. And I enrolled in the master's program at Arizona State. It's not finished because I've been so busy performing and recording, but at some point I'll finish the master's. I'm not in a hurry for that, but I continue to do a lot of independent study. And one of the great things about traveling around is I get to meet music therapists and observe, and I have wonderful stories about things people are doing with music. And it's more than you might think. It's not just using music for relaxation. You can also use music in psychotherapy. You could use music to build a bridge of trust, maybe with a young person who's not really talking about what's going on, and maybe you could share music and build some trust there. Music is useful in neurological rehabilitation, like if someone's had an accident, a stroke, maybe trauma to the brain, they lose some of the functioning of their brain. Music can actually help to bring that functioning back. music is also very physical. The actual making of music, there's a whole physical task, like playing the drums, for example, can be exercising to the body as well as expressing some of those intense emotions that we feel. I mean, it just goes on and on. Respiratory conditions, singing or playing a wind instrument can help with that. Just a few examples.
You mentioned you're touring these days both as a solo performer and with your trio. When you're doing this, does your playing have to be, I don't know, more expressive when you're by yourself as opposed to with a trio?
I do approach it a little differently when I'm playing solo. It's funny because a lot of people I know, they commend me for doing these solo concerts. A lot of musicians I know, because they say, man, how do you do that? I would never play a solo concert. And I've been doing it for so long that I'm accustomed to it. But I do have to say it's more work because I don't have anyone to lean on. You know, if I'm playing with my trio, I feel a little tired. Give the drummer a little extra solo time, you know. But I love that intimacy and that connection with the audience. And a lot of times I'm making it up as I go along. I like being on the edge. And, you know, sometimes I almost fall off and I have to pull back. I love that experimentation. And I do really like the fact that there's a connection to the audience, a closeness of a connection that I only really feel when I'm playing my solo shows.
Also, I was going to ask, too, for all the guitar players out there, what guitars do you take with you on the road these days?
I have one guitar with me. It's been my main guitar since the late 80s. It's made by Patrice Vigée in Paris, and it is an Arpège model. And Vigée guitars are very accurate. They have a very crystal clear sound. And for my touch technique, I find that it's really suitable because the guitar is so accurate. See, I have to make some special adjustments. I have to get the strings down close to the neck to do this technique properly. And most guitars aren't really set up for that because once you get those strings down close, the guitar's not accurate enough and you start getting buzzing and artifacts and so forth. This guitar, I lowered it right off the shelf and immediately I could get the sound I wanted. So that's one of the things people ask me, can you do this on any guitar? Well, you can up to a point, but most guitars need some work in order to have the right setup.
And do you make these modifications yourself?
No, I don't do it myself. In the beginning, I did because I was the only one who knew what I wanted to do. But what's happened is over the time, since then, more and more people have wanted that, what they call the action, that low action. And so there are more and more guitar luthiers and people who work on guitars who have the chops to get that accurate setup.
What's in your future? I mean, you mentioned the Friends album. It's been a couple of years. Any new CDs coming out?
I'm working on one right now. I might actually be doing a project with Kevin Eubanks. We've done a lot of duet performances together, and now we've been talking about doing some recording together. I've been doing a lot of collaborations and really branching out with diverse artists. I've been playing with a lot of rock bands and bands in the jam band scene. Dave Matthews is one example. I did a lot of the shows on the summer tour last year, and I've already done a few shows on the tour this year. Other rock bands like Humphreys McGee and diverse bands like String Cheese Incident. Last week, I just played Phil and Friends with Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead.
Wow.
And that was amazing because that Grateful Dead music is a big body of work, and it's challenging. I mean, there are so many moments when you have to go to a different meter or a certain interpretation just for one measure. There's a certain thing you have to do just to get the right vibe. The Dead music is, it's like the deeper you peel the onion, the more there is there. And actually, that music was influential for me back in the day because the Grateful Dead music, being creative and having all those open jams, influenced me to get interested in jazz. So there's definitely a connection there. So that's what I've been doing. I've been doing a lot of interesting collaborations, and I think whatever my upcoming releases will be, it's going to reflect some of that.
Lastly, I wanted to ask, too, any more movies? We're talking Blind Date, 1986, the Blake Edwards movie with Bruce Willis. And right in the middle of it, there's a scene that takes place in a recording studio, and that's where you show up.
Yeah, I had a great time doing that scene. I studied acting as a child, and I'm still interested in that. You know, to tell you the truth, though, what I'm mostly interested in is film scoring. And I have scored a couple of short films, and I'm making some moves now toward really getting my equipment set up to make it easier to do scoring. A lot of people are using the computer these days for doing film scores. So I'm looking toward the future, interested in doing more of that kind of work. I'm getting set up and getting ready for that.
Your practice regimen, how often do you practice?
I try to practice 5 hours a day. Since I've been on the road, it's not always possible. A lot of times there are things that I can do even without a guitar in my hands. There are mental exercises. There are things I can do physically with my hands, even without the instrument, that still count towards my practice time. Even those little moments when I'm waiting for the plane to take off or whatever. So when you add that up, it probably ends up actually being more than 5 hours a day.
Well, thank you very much for sharing all that with us. We've been speaking with guitarist Stanley Jordan. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Great talking with you, Frank.
And for Around Cincinnati, I'm Frank Johnson.